different kingdoms and the taxonomic hierarchy. One group of so-called organisms that really doesn't fit well into our taxonomic hierarchy are viruses. Okay, now, this is a picture of a virus. And if you remember the cell theory, when we talked about cells way back when, one of the parts of the cell theory was that cells are the smallest living thing. There's nothing smaller than a cell, right? And viruses, if you look at their structure here, they have a nucleic acid right here inside of a protein. They really don't have any organelles, or they really don't even have a plasma membrane. So therefore, they're smaller than a cell. They really don't have the components of a cell. And so because of that, viruses are kind of hard to define. They're not really what we would call living, but yet they're, I guess you could say, more alive than a piece of wood, or, you know, a piece of dead wood or a piece of cement. They live inside of other organisms. And so viruses are kind of a strange group of so-called organisms. Typically, viruses are one of two types. What they'll either be is they're what we call an RNA virus or a DNA virus. Okay, and the major difference is that RNA viruses, of course, are going to have the nucleic acid RNA inside the virus. DNA viruses are going to have DNA as the nucleic acid. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things is that viruses typically cannot survive outside of a cell, right? Or at least not for a very long period of time outside of a cell. For example, you all know of one notorious virus called the HIV virus, right? If I had the HIV virus, if I were to sneeze on you, could you catch the HIV virus? Even if you wanted to make out with me, would you get the HIV virus? Okay. No. Or if I urinated on a toilet seat and you come and sit down on the toilet seat, could you get the HIV virus? The answer is no. And the reason why is the HIV virus, when it's outside of the cell, it dies very, very quickly. Now, there are some other viruses that live for a little bit longer outside of the cellular structure, but not for very long, such as this one here, the influenza virus, which causes the flu. Now, if I had the flu, I could actually pass it to you airborne, but you would have to be fairly close to me, and I'd probably have to sneeze right on you. Okay. So some viruses can be passed, and they can survive outside of the cell for short periods of time, but not typically for very long. Right. Any questions about that?
You said outside of the cell?
Yeah, outside of the cell.
I've heard with like blood after 5 seconds, if someone's bleeding that has HIV, then you can't catch anymore from that. Is there any?
That's probably not true.
No, you can still catch it from blood.
If it's in blood, and you have an open cut or something, that's why people wear gloves and so forth when they're working on, you know, an emergency room and so forth. If you have an open cut, it could actually be passed that way. It's very unlikely, but it is possible. Okay. It's more commonly passed when you have intimate contact of body fluids, like sexual contact or blood transfusions, or another way that actually it's somewhat commonly transferred is through using common needles. Okay. Like in drugs, or, you know, if you're a doctor and you're working on somebody with HIV and you actually accidentally stick yourself. Kind of, okay. There are lots of viruses in the world, all right? We talked about HIV, influenza. What are some other viruses that you can think of?
Rhinovirus.
What?
Rhinovirus.
Rhinovirus, okay. Actually, most of you probably...
Cold sores, viruses?
Yeah, cold sores. Actually, how many of you have cold sores around your mouth or your nose or something? Only one person will admit it. That's actually a herpes class virus, okay? It's not the when you normally think of herpes viruses, you think of the STD, right, sexually transmitted disease. There are actually quite a few different types of herpes virus. If you get cold sores periodically, or like I get cold sores around my nose periodically for some reason, I don't really get them in my mouth. That's a herpes class virus. Okay. And that, yeah, go ahead.
I heard that you can like get them from like having too much citrus or like if you eat too much tomatoes, it'll like activate it. Is that true?
Kind of. There's an ounce of truth in there. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah.
What you're probably doing is, we'll go through the life cycle of virus, you're probably kicking it into a different part of the life cycle when it, you see the activation of it. Another very common virus that's found in the world is the common cold. Most of your colds are viral in nature. The flu or influenza is a virus. Warts are viruses. Okay. Both the kind of warts you get on your hand and genital warts, all right? Sexually transmitted disease again. Polio is a virus. Chickenpox is a virus. Okay. Smallpox are viruses. All right. So there's lots of different types of viruses. Now, we're going to talk about... Yeah, go ahead.
Is there differences between viruses that humans can get and animals can get?
Are there? He asks if there's differences between the viruses that humans get and other animals get, and the answer is sometimes, not all the time. Actually, there are some viruses such as the Ebola virus. Have you ever heard of the Ebola virus? When it gets introduced into a human population, it kills almost 100% of all humans that get it. One interesting thing I found, I was reading in National Geographic a couple of months ago. The number one reservoir for viruses in the world are bat populations. They used to think that, for example, Ebola virus was carried in the in primate populations, monkeys, apes, so forth. What they found is that the Ebola virus, if it gets into a primate population, it'll actually kill them off. And they're actually harbored in bats. It's kind of interesting. The reason why we thought that they were harbored in primate populations was we actually found that that's where it was introduced into human populations most commonly, is humans picking up, for example, a dead monkey and then eating it. Okay, and so that's why we thought it was harbored there, but they're actually, it's harbored in bats. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things about viruses is that DNA viruses are typically a little bit more stable than RNA viruses. RNA viruses tend to mutate much more quickly than DNA viruses. Okay, so what that means is that you've all heard about immunizations for viral infections. In fact, most of you probably had them before, right? Some of you have probably had the shots for chickenpox. Many of you had those. Okay, if not, you've at least had them for polio. Because most of you have polio vaccinations before, probably when you were really little. It's one that the state law mandates that you get, or you know, tells you you should get, you have to get before you get into elementary school. Those viruses are actually DNA viruses. And the reason why we can actually produce inoculants for them or immunizations for them is because they don't mutate very quickly. Okay? And so what happens when you immunize somebody for something is we actually take, for example, the polio virus, and they actually just change it quite very, very slightly and then put a marker on it so that your body realizes it's a foreign structure. And so when they immunize you, your body starts to attack that, and it actually, your body has a memory. And so it can actually remember what that virus is like. So if you're ever infected with polio virus again, your body will know to attack it. Kind of thing. Okay. That's essentially how immunizations work.
So, are cold sores and warts, are they RNA viruses? Because you think you
most of them are RNA viruses, yeah. Not all of them. Some of them just have not had immunizations developed because they're not that critical. Okay, polio can be a very debilitating disease, right? Chickenpox can be debilitating and can cause permanent scarring. I actually have scars from when I had chickenpox. I think it's right there. I can't remember which side my head it's on, but I have a big old chickenpox scar.
Is tuberculosis a type of virus?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But you don't see immunizations for something like HIV, right? Why? It's an RNA virus, and it actually mutates very, very quickly, much more quickly than many other viruses. If everybody in here were to have HIV virus and we all caught it from this, each other, does that make sense? In other words, if we just spread it within this classroom, probably there would be at least 15 or 20 different types of HIV virus in this room. Does that make sense? So, in other words, it mutates almost instantaneously.
So yeah. Is that why they have the flu shot every year?
Yeah, that's why this year I got the flu shot and I caught the flu in this class, right? Because this year's flu was not the same class of flu as they had in the flu shot. Next year they're actually going to immunize for 3 different types of flu. Okay. This year they only did 2 and they missed the one that's most common that's really knocking everybody down. Yeah.
Is that true about the statement, once you get a cold or a virus or whatever, you won't get it again?
Yep. Actually, no. Once you get it, you never get rid of it, is what happens.
Do you get sick again, though?
You can.
From the same virus?
Yep, you can. It depends on the virus. If it's close enough to its parent virus, you may or may not get sick. Sometimes the viruses will flare up. Okay. And really what's happening is there's really 2 parts to the viral life cycle. We're not going to get into the life cycle in a lot of detail, but what I want you to realize is this. In the virus life cycle, there's really 2 parts to it. There's what we call the lysogenic part of the life cycle and the lytic part of the life cycle. In the lysogenic part of the life cycle, what happens is the viral DNA or RNA invades the cell. And the way that it sneaks into the cell is with the protein coat that surrounds that nucleic acid. Remember, we looked at that kind of studded protein coat. Many of those protein coats actually trick the cell into thinking that they're okay proteins, that they're not harmful proteins. Does that kind of make sense to everybody? So once that viral nucleic acid gets into the cell, it just kind of hides itself in the cell. This particular virus that we're looking at here in this bacterium is a DNA virus. And so what it actually does is it incorporates its DNA into the cell's DNA. And so all of a sudden, the viral DNA becomes a part of the DNA of the cell. Okay? Any questions about that? Now, what happens is when that cell divides, when it goes through mitosis, what happens to the viral DNA that's already part of the cell's DNA? It divides as well. Okay? It just basically, the cell just thinks it's part of its own DNA. And then when the cells divide again, we get new viral DNA in each of the new cells. Now, periodically, what happens is most viruses will go into what we call the lytic stage. This is when they're infectious. And in the lytic stage, essentially what they do is they take the cell hostage. And instead of the cell making normal proteins and so forth like we've talked about, what the cell does is it actually, or what the virus does is it takes the cell hostage. And the only thing that the cell produces almost are more pieces of viral DNA or RNA and the proteins that surround them. Does that kind of make sense? And so what happens is you get a whole bunch of new viruses in these cells. And pretty soon these cells are going to die because they are not getting the type of nutrition and so forth that they normally need. And they're basically held hostage by the virus. And so then these cells break. And when they break, then the new viruses can be released. And that's typically when infection from new viruses occurs. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. So, once you get a virus, can you ever cure yourself or be cured of a viral infection? Answer is you can. In other words, that virus is always going to be in your cells. Does that make sense?
So the body just learns how to control it?
Yeah, either the immune, sometimes the immune system will be able to attack it, but sometimes the immune system can attack it when it goes into the lytic stage. And when it goes into the lytic stage, that's usually again when it's infectious, but many times the body can't deal with that. For example, in the herpes viruses that we were talking about, periodically I get cold sores. Can I control it? Can my body control it? Not really. What's happening is those viruses are going into the lytic stage of their life cycle. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Or you've all heard of the HIV virus. What happens when people get AIDS?
It's when the HIV comes in.
Yeah, basically they're really infectious at that point, right? And they're basically in the lytic stage of the viral life cycle. Yeah.
So how do people get chickenpox 3 times?
How can they get it 2 times?
I've had chickenpox 3 times. So like, how does that
well,
happen?
Either one of a couple of things is happening. More than likely, your immune system isn't working the way that it probably should. Okay, if you get chickenpox that many times, you probably need to have somebody go to look at your immunological system. The other thing that can be happen is not all chickenpox viruses are equal. Okay, and so periodically there will be a new virus that comes in. It's kind of like the flu. And so if it's mutated a little bit, maybe your body doesn't recognize it as a foreign virus. Okay. Any questions about viruses? Yeah?
Is model a virus?
It is.
And you keep that throughout your life, don't you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just like all other viruses. Just the body is able to realize when some viruses flare up and deal with them. And there's a lot of complications as to why, or a lot of, it's fairly complex as to why that occurs with some viruses and not other viruses. Most viruses, though, the body cannot control. That's why when your body gets run down, and what happens is you tend to get viral infections, right? And it may not be that you caught a new virus, it may just be what? An old virus flaring up. So the cold that you had a week ago may have been the cold that you had 6 months ago, the same exact cold. It's just laid dormant for those 6 months. Does that make sense? And at least in my body, and this is true of most people, is when your body becomes stressed, either psychologically or physically stressed, that's when viruses tend to shift over into the lytic cycle, right? I mean, if you think about the viruses, the viral infections you've had, one virus that can be very serious in young kids. Oh, crying. I lost the name of it. Is RSV virus. That's, you ever heard of that? My little boy that we adopted actually had that when he was about, 6 months old. It wasn't fun to sit in the hospital for 2 weeks. Hoping that he's not going to die. There's really nothing you can do about it except put them in an oxygen tent. Hopefully they get enough oxygen. So, any questions about viruses in general?
I just want to make sure I understand the lytic cycle. So the lytic cycle is just basically when your immune system can't hold it anymore?
No, it's actually when the virus takes the cell hostage.
Okay.
And sometimes the immune system will be able to attack those new viruses that are being produced and stop the cells from kind of override the hostage taking. So you can kind of think of it almost in an analogy of a real world human situation. Every once in a while the cops are able to get the hostage takers without killing any of the hostages type of a thing. Other times when they attack, they kill not only the hostages but the hostage takers, and sometimes the hostage takers just get away. Kind of similar to what happens in the body.
Does that usually happen in prophage?
Yeah, the phages are actually only don't attack all organisms. Phages are just phages are a type of a viral type. Any other questions? Okay. Any questions about the viruses? Okay. Now what I'd like to do is go back and talk about the characteristics of the different kingdoms of the organisms. Now, as we mentioned before, we talked about three different domains, and then actually six kingdoms is what it introduces in your book. What I want to do is kind of go back to the five kingdom system just to for a couple of minutes, and then we'll talk about the bacteria and why they are not always classified the same. But in the five kingdom system of classification, there is what we call the kingdom Monera, the kingdom Protista, the kingdom Fungi, the kingdom Plantae, and the kingdom Animalia. Those are the five kingdoms. Now what I'd like to do is introduce the characteristics of each of these five kingdoms. All right. Boy, somebody's throwing every one of these markers. I need to go grab some more. Characteristics of these or of each of these kingdoms. Well, first of all, the Monera are sometimes what we call the bacteria, and as we talk about the Monera a little bit later on, we're actually going to split them into actually two different domains and two different kingdoms. But the Monera are prokaryotic organisms. Okay, what is a prokaryotic cell again?
Yeah. It has membrane bound to the nucleus.
Okay, it has no membrane-bound organelles in the nucleus, right? Okay, and eukaryotic are the type, you're backwards, which is fine. Eukaryotic have what? They have the membrane-bound organelles and nucleus, okay? All of the other kingdoms contain organisms that have eukaryotic cells. So they all have eukaryotic cells. The Monera have prokaryotic cells. Now this is what we would call, you'll hear me use this terminology quite a bit from now until the end of the semester. What is a distinguishing characteristic versus a non-distinguishing characteristic? Well, a distinguishing characteristic is something that makes the organism unique. Does that make sense? A non-distinguishing characteristic is any characteristic the organism may have, but it doesn't make them unique. Okay. For example, if you were to compare mammals and birds, we have a lot of characteristics that are the same, right? We both have a head. We both have an intestine. We both have many different structures. Those are all structures that organism has. The distinguishing characteristics between birds and mammals is mammals have hair, birds have feathers, right? That makes sense. So those are unique characteristics for those organisms. So Monera, they have a distinguishing characteristic of being prokaryotic. In addition, Monera are single-celled organisms, as are protists. Now what we'll find out is that when we cover the Protista in your textbook, I actually disagree with the way that your textbook classifies the protists, so we're going to use a different way of classifying protists. There's kind of multiple trends of thought on how to classify Protista. It's one of those groups of organisms that doesn't have a really good definition. So we're going to just define them as single-celled eukaryotic organisms. The fungi, plants, and animals are all multi-celled organisms. Okay. Any questions about that? So the fungi, plants, and animals, they're all eukaryotic, they're all multi-celled. So how do you distinguish between these three groups of organisms? Well, there are a couple of ways. One way is by looking at how they get their nutrition. Plants are autotrophs. What is an autotroph?
To provide its own food.
Okay, it gets its own food usually through what?
Another source.
photosynthesis.
Yeah, through photosynthesis, right? Okay, most of the time. We're actually going to talk about some autotrophic bacteria that are not photosynthetic autotrophs. They're actually what we call chemiautotrophs, which is kind of the exception rather than the rule. Whereas fungi and animals are both heterotrophs. So the animals and the fungi are both heterotrophs. Now we can actually distinguish heterotrophs by the way in which they get their food. And so we're going to do that here. Fungi are what we call saprobes, and animals do something that we call ingest their food. Okay. Now what's the difference between that? Well, both of them are heterotrophic, which means that they both get their nutrients from other organisms, right? Okay. Animals ingest their food. What that means is that they take their food inside of their body or inside of their cells to digest. Is that true of us?
Yeah.
Right. We swallow our food, it goes inside of our body and is digested inside of our body. Okay. Fungi, on the other hand, are what we call saprobes. Saprobes work a little bit differently. What fungi do is they actually secrete digestive enzymes and release those enzymes outside of their body. Digestion occurs outside of the body, and then they reabsorb digested nutrients. Okay? So most of you are familiar with black bread mold. You probably have some in your apartment right now, right? Okay? If you feel right underneath the top of that black bread mold, you'll feel it almost will feel like somebody spit on the bread. Okay? And that's because that black bread mold is releasing enzymes. And then digestion is occurring outside of the body, and then it's absorbing those digested nutrients. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So that's what a saprobe is. One other thing that makes animals quite unique is that they are mobile, whereas plants and fungi are immobile. In other words, what does that mean? Animals can move, right? Plants don't move. Now, animals, some of them are actually sessile, or they don't move a whole lot. But kind of the caveat here is this. Animals need to be able to move at some point in their life cycle. Plants can't really move at any point in their life cycle, and neither can fungi. Okay? In other words, they can't get up and walk from one place to another. Any questions about those characteristics? Now, it wouldn't be hard to memorize all of these characteristics with the five kingdoms. And the reason why it wouldn't be that difficult is because there's not too many characteristics here, right? When we start talking about 15 or 20 different phyla of animals and a number of different classes within each phyla, number of orders within some of the classes, there's going to be a lot of information, a lot of terminology, a lot of characteristics to realize. So one way of actually studying and learning characteristics of organisms is by looking at similarities and differences between organisms. And you can do that in a number of different ways. One way that biologists use to classify organisms or to look at similarities or differences between organisms is by using something that we call a dichotomous key. Okay? Now, a dichotomous key is what scientists will use to classify organisms. So for example, if you brought me an insect and you said, Dr. Stevens, what's the name, scientific name of this insect? Well, if it's a common insect, I might just know it off the top of my head, right? Because I've seen it enough times. But if it's not something I've seen, how would I find out how to name it? Yeah, I'd use a dichotomous key in a big old book, okay? What I would do is I'd open up the book, and instead of going through 1,000 pages and reading all the descriptions of the insects, that would take me forever, right? So I would never classify anything for anybody because I'm too lazy to do that, all right? What you do is you actually open up the book, and it has a dichotomous key, and it has two contrasting characteristics. You can look at that insect and say, okay, which of those characteristics does it have, okay? And then you go to the next question, and then it will have two more contrasting characteristics. And then you get to look at the insect and say, oh, how's that characteristic? And then you move on to the next question, okay? And pretty soon you would get a scientific name for that insect, all right? So let me just show you how dichotomous keys can be constructed and how they can be used, okay? A couple of different ways. Now, dichotomy means two, right? So a dichotomy is a forking pathway. And so if we were to write a dichotomous key for the kingdoms, we could do it this way, okay? And I'm going to show you some multiple dichotomous keys just to kind of give you an example. In dichotomous keys, usually we start out with two statements. We usually label them 1A and 1B. And the reason, and the rule is with dichotomous keys, you read the 1A statement, and then if it doesn't apply, you read the B statement. Does that make sense? Okay, so it's either or. So for example, we could use a characteristic and split these two organisms, or these two kingdoms, from these three, right? We could say, okay, single cell and multi-cell. Okay. Now, there are a couple of different kingdoms that are single-celled, right? And there are a couple of different kingdoms that are multi-celled. So what we need to do is we need to go to the next step if we were going to determine whether or not it was a bacterium or a protist. Okay. And so what you would do is you'd just go to the next number. It doesn't matter what the number is. In this case, it's 2A. Okay. So if we had a single-celled organism, we would go to 2A, and we write 2A and 2B, because you write contrasting statements every time, all right? Now, which of the kingdoms are single-celled again? Monera and Protista, right? So how would we separate out the Monera and Protista?
Prokaryotic.
Yeah, prokaryotic, eukaryotic. The prokaryotic organisms that are single-celled would be Monera, and the eukaryotic organisms that are single-celled would be Protista. Okay. Now, if we come back up here to the multi-celled organisms, the next number in the table, or in the dichotomous key, happens to be 3. So we'll say, okay, go to 3A. So we write 3A, 3B. How are one of these three kingdoms different from the other two? Okay, heterotroph, autotroph. Okay. Now, are either of these a distinguishing characteristic along with being multi-celled for any of the kingdoms?
Autotroph.
Yeah, if you're autotrophic and multi-celled, then that distinguishes what? The plants, right? Is being heterotrophic and multi-celled, is that a distinguishing group of characteristics for any one kingdom? It's not. We have both the animals and the fungi that have those characteristics, right? So we need to go to the next number, which happens to be 4A in this case. So 4A, 4B, right? How could we separate the animals and the fungi from one another? Okay, there's a couple of different things we could use. We could use ingest versus saprobe, right? Okay, or we could use what?
Mobile,
immobile, right? So let's just use that for... So which one is mobile?
The animal.
Okay, Animalia. And which one is immobile? The fungi. Now, using these dichotomous keys, you can work backwards. For example, the animals that are mobile, and where do we get 4A from? Right here. They're heterotrophs. Where do we get 3A? Multicell organisms. Any questions about that? So you can work backwards as well. Now, let me just show you another way to kind of look at dichotomous keys here. You could actually use kind of a flow chart type of a structure. So really what we have is we have a dichotomy or a split here, okay? 1A and 1B. On 1A we said that they are single cell, and on 1B we said that they're what? Multi cell. Okay. Everybody with me? Okay, so we have a split. With those that are single cell, we said we have another split here. We have those that are what? Prokaryotic. And those that are eukaryotic. Those that are prokaryotic and single cell are the Monera. And those that are eukaryotic and single cell are the Protista. Okay? In the multicell organisms, we said we had a split. That's right here on 3A, right? We said that some were what? Some were heterotrophs. And some are autotrophs. Okay? The autotrophic multicell organisms are the plants. Okay, right? Any questions about that? The heterotrophic multicell organisms, we said, well, we need another division here, right? And on this division, we used what characteristic? Mobile. Immobile. And the mobile would be the animalia. The immobile would be the fungi. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, if you were to memorize a dichotomous key, of course, with the kingdoms, there's not very many characteristics, so it's, you know, it wouldn't be that hard to memorize all the characteristics. But if you memorize the dichotomous key for the organisms that we're going to be talking about, most of the time, you could get most of the answers on a test. Okay, probably over 80% of the answers if you knew a dichotomous key. Does that make sense? The only question that I could ask you about these organisms with this dichotomous key that you wouldn't be able to get from the dichotomous key would be what? Yeah, if I asked you something about animals ingesting their food or fungi being saprobes. Does that make sense? Okay. So what I'm saying is this. You know over 80% of the material, so on a test you could probably figure out over 80% of what's supposed to be there. Does that make sense? Now those of you who are A students, you probably need to what? Need to learn all the characteristics. Okay. Any questions? Is that the only dichotomous key we could write for the kingdoms? No, we could actually write, there's lots of different dichotomous keys we could write. Okay. Let me just show you a couple of others here. We could start out with the characteristic 1A, 1B, prokaryotic and eukaryotic. Prokaryotic, we would say those are the Monera. Eukaryotic, those would be the other four kingdoms, so we would go to 2A. 2A, 2B, single cell versus multicell. Single cell would be Protista. Multicell, we would have to go to 3A. 3A, 3B. What didn't we use over here? Let's do this first. Yeah, let's go this way. Mobile. Immobile. Okay. Mobile would be animalia. Immobile. 4A. 4A, 4B. And we could say ingest food, or excuse me, saprobes and autotrophs. Saprobes would be the fungi, and the autotrophs would be the plantae. Okay. Any questions about it? We actually construct a number of other different dichotomous keys. Every dichotomous key, there are some advantages and disadvantages to it, right? Okay. For example, here you would have to remember that animals are heterotrophic and ingest their food. That's about the only thing that you don't get on this dichotomous key. That makes sense. Any questions about dichotomous keys or how to use them or how to construct them?
So for like a question that you'd have in the test, like what kind of question would you have that'd be this, like, you show us a picture of a grasshopper and say, what is it? Do we have to do this and find out?
Yeah, you could do, I could do that, or I could say, construct a dichotomous key for the kingdoms, or I could say, here's a dichotomous key, fill in the kingdoms in this dichotomous key, any of the above. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Or I could just ask you about animals. And if you knew this characteristics of the kingdom animalia, if you knew one of these two dichotomous keys, you know most, or at least some of the characteristics of animalia. So you could probably answer questions about animals without really having to memorize all the characteristics of animals. Does that make sense? Or at least most of them. You may lose... You know, you may miss out on a question here or there, but you should be able to answer the majority of the questions. Okay. Any other questions about dichotomous keys? Okay, so with dichotomous keys, they're just simply kind of an organized way that scientists use to classify organisms and to show how organisms are similar and how they're different. One thing that we didn't talk a whole lot about here with these keys is you can actually group organisms into different groups here. You can say, okay, how are organisms similar and how are they different? Okay? Protists and Monera are similar in that they both have what? A single cell. Okay? The plants, fungi, and animals are similar in that they are all multicelled. The fungi and animals are similar in that they're both heterotrophs. Okay, does that make sense? Or you could ask a question, how are plants and animals different? Well, you have that here. One of them is autotrophic and one of them is heterotrophic. Okay. Any questions about dichotomous keys? Okay, so what I would hope that you would do is write some of your own dichotomous keys, possibly. And we'll actually write a few dichotomous keys in class to kind of show you how it's done so that you can do well on the next exam. All right? Any questions?